Judgment at Gitmo, Judgment at Nuremberg.
The principle of criminal law in every civilized society has this in common. Any person who sways another to commit murder, any person who furnishes the lethal weapon for the purpose of the crime, any person who is an accessory to the crime is guilty.
Convicted defendant Salim Hamdan apparently meets the test of being an accessory, but is it enough to satisfy the verdict of history? Terror, tribunals, and the rule of law on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 7th. August 7th, all day long. The U.S.'s first war crimes trial since World War II has come to an end with a split verdict. More details on the case against the Army scientist accused of the 2001 anthrax attacks. And the Olympics begin tomorrow. Which athletes will you be watching? We have a few suggestions. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora. On the eve of the Olympic Games, President Bush urged China to improve its human rights record. Speaking in Bangkok, the president called for greater rights for religious believers and political dissidents.
The United States believes the people of China deserve the fundamental liberty that is the natural right of all human beings.
President Bush is due to arrive in Beijing later this morning. The FBI has released hundreds of documents they collected in building their case against Army scientist Bruce Ivins in the 2001 anthrax attacks. The documents show Ivins was the sole custodian of the unique strain of anthrax that killed five people. Ivins committed suicide last week.
Today at Guantanamo Bay, sentencing proceedings continue against Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, following his conviction yesterday of providing material support to al-Qaeda and acquittal of conspiracy charges. Here's the ACLU's Ben Wisner.
Never in the history of the law of war has a military tribunal been convened to punish such a low-level offender for such low-level charges.
Hamdan faces life in prison. A senior official of the UN Nuclear Agency has arrived in Iran for talks on the country's nuclear program. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany are considering adding more sanctions on Iran because of its refusal to stop enriching uranium.
Today marks the 10-year anniversary of the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The coordinated attacks killed more than 200 people and wounded thousands.
And once again, the saga of Brett Favre has ended with a trade. The former Green Bay quarterback will join the New York Jets. Aaron Rodgers is expected to start for Green Bay. Aaron Rodgers must be a happy man this morning.
Really happy.
John McCain continues to campaign in Ohio today. Barack Obama begins the day in Minneapolis before heading home to Chicago.
Oil is down slightly in Asian trading, $118 a barrel. The S&P rose 3.5% or 0.35%. It opens at 1289. We're talking about the Olympic Games. Who and what events are you going to be watching at the Games? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking about local, buying local produce, a conversation that was teed up yesterday that a lot of people are involved in, and also grief. How do you handle it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Lots more in the show.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. After a two-week trial and jury deliberations of 8 hours, the first war crimes trial in the U.S. came to an end. A split decision for Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver. He was acquitted of conspiracy charges but found guilty of materially supporting terrorism. Today, the sentencing proceedings against him will continue, as will the debate on the legitimacy of the verdict, as the government promises more terror trials ahead. Joining us now for a breakdown is Alan Gomez, a reporter for USA Today, who's been covering the trial at Guantanamo Bay. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
Could you set the scene for us yesterday when the jury's verdict was read?
When the verdict was read, it was a obviously very quiet in there. Mr. Hamdan didn't show a lot of emotion at first. Defense attorneys later explained that he was very much confused by the split verdict. The way it broke down is there was 10 different specifications, so there was a very long series of guilties and not guilties, and he had dropped his head down into his hand. He wiped his eyes a little bit with the back
looked like a trial that we would be familiar with. Was he standing? Was the jury foreman standing? Did the judge read the verdict?
And yeah, it was very traditional in that sense. They came in. He stood up, and after reviewing the findings and writing a couple of notes on the jury form, he returned it to the jury for a foreperson and read it out loud in court.
So unravel the decision for us. It was a split decision, so there was something in there for both prosecutors and defense counsel.
Exactly. For prosecutors, they walk away with getting a conviction on the first war crimes trial in the United States since World War II. So that's obviously, they didn't strike out in their first attempt here. But very much the defense is calling this at least a partial victory. He was acquitted of what they consider to be the much more serious charge of conspiracy. And looking forward, defense attorneys, critics of the commission, and even supporters of the commission are looking at this as a troubling sign for prosecutors as they try to charge conspiracy against all these other Guantanamo detainees. A lot of them have this charge. It might be a little easier on some of the more high-ranking detainees. But for the lower-ranking kind of sort of foot soldier sort of folks that they have down here, it shows that this conspiracy charge is going to be pretty hard to prosecute.
Can you explain to us then what the jury found Hamdan guilty of exactly and what the prosecutors could not specifically prove?
The charges that he was found guilty of dealt specifically with his role as a bodyguard, as a driver of bin Laden, as being part of the group. But what he was acquitted of was anything that had to do with planning, anything that had to do with having previous knowledge of the Cole attack in 2000, of the September 11th terror attacks, anything that had to do with him actually being a conspirer in the planning of those operations. He was just basically convicted, from what we can tell, on charges that he was a driver and a bodyguard and nothing more.
Let's listen to a Pentagon spokesman's response to the verdict.
Mr. Hamdan did receive a full and fair trial. He was convicted of material support to terrorism, 5 specifications out of 8 that he was charged with. And as we can see, the military commission's process is moving forward.
Moving forward and fair. Alan, obviously you've been covering this trial, and there's been a tremendous amount of criticism over the years as the Bush administration has put these trials together. The White House also called it a full and fair trial, but there were certainly others who said it really wasn't.
Absolutely. This is the defense attorney is they've had their appeals pretty much laid out since long before the jury came back with this decision. There's questions about the kind of evidence that was introduced here. They question the use of evidence obtained through coercive interrogations that will surely be coming up on appeal. They disapprove of a lot of the hearsay evidence that was used in this, even though hearsay evidence has long been used in that war tribunal. So this is far from over. These cases have already made it up to the Supreme Court, so they obviously have some appellate legs, and it looks like that will definitely be the case in this case.
Alan Gomez, many thanks for that update.
Absolutely.
Alan Gomez reports for USA Today, and he's been covering Hamdan's trial and at Guantanamo Bay.
Certainly what prosecutors are going to want to know is how wide a net is this material support test? In other words, if you made a ham sandwich for someone in Al-Qaeda, are you giving material support to terrorists? We're going to talk about that a little later on in the program. Lots more on the verdict to come. But as the verdict was being announced in Guantanamo Bay, the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. yesterday was unsealing documents in the 2001 anthrax case. The new documents in the investigation have been made public. Yesterday, DOJ said the case was still open. Today, it appears it may be closed. Scott Shane is a reporter for the New York Times. He joins us from Washington. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
The unsealing of these documents makes it clear why Bruce Ivins, who committed suicide last week, was a suspicious person and someone worthy of investigation. The DOJ says he was the only person responsible. How do they make that case?
Well, they make the case with a long list of evidence, but all of it is circumstantial. There's no smoking gun. There's no direct proof that he was the guy who mailed these letters that killed 5 people and set off a huge national panic about bioterrorism in 2001. Many people yesterday found the overall weight of the evidence they produced fairly compelling, but there were definitely holes in it, and his lawyers are still asserting his innocence, and they described what was released as, quote, heaps of innuendo, and indeed a lot of it went to proving that he was a bizarre guy with some very unusual behavior.
Well, Scott, let's
but
listen.
Not all of that was related to the anthrax.
Let me get you to evaluate this statement from Jeffrey Taylor, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who at the news conference yesterday that you witnessed one way or another, talk about some of the behaviors of Ivins that were particularly suspicious.
In the days leading up to each of the mailings, the documents make clear that Dr. Ivins was working inordinate hours alone at night and on the weekend in the lab where the flask of spores and production equipment were stored.
Now that sounds damning, but the idea of a biologist, a scientist, working inordinate hours alone at night is also kind of easy to understand, right?
Well, that's right, and in fact, colleagues said that Ivins was a night owl who sometimes worked in the lab at night. And in fact, a lot of the other scientists there say that when they have a project with a deadline or a project they're really interested in, they'll come in and work late at night. Perhaps more damning was that when they asked Ivins about why he was in the lab so much at night before the letters were mailed, his explanation was sort of a vague reference to domestic problems at home and wanting to escape from home to the lab, but nothing very specific about what he was working on.
Scott, if he was, as they say, solely responsible, and investigators believed that for the anthrax attacks, why was he not in custody? Why was he not arrested?
Well, that's a great question, one that several members of Congress were asking yesterday. Undoubtedly, there will be hearings on this. And the FBI is under pressure to release a lot more information than it released yesterday. But one reason was that they, by their own admission now, were sidetracked by the wrong man, Stephen Hatfill, another scientist who had worked at the same Army lab in Frederick, Maryland. And the investigators were so focused on him for 2 years, maybe 3 years, that they ignored what they now consider to be suspicious evidence regarding Dr. Ivins.
Although, Scott, there is a major hole in the case, and that is nothing in the documents unsealed yesterday links Ivins to the actual letters themselves, any of the enormous amount of evidence of stuff that was sent out, right?
That's right. Plus, in very, very careful examinations of his home and his cars, they couldn't find a single spore of anthrax,
really,
which his defense attorneys are also putting forward as evidence of his innocence.
Well, Scott, before we go, if this was a chapter 4 in a Robert Ludlum novel, I guess next week there would be another anthrax attack, right?
There is a
chilling quality here, don't you think?
There is, and one of the things that's frightening is that Stephen Hatfill was distraught in 2002 when he was being targeted by the FBI and came near suicide by the account of friends. If he had killed himself in 2002, would there have been a press conference announcing that they had their man at that time?
Well, Scott Shane, many questions answered, but still some chilling questions on the table in the anthrax case. Scott Shane, New York Times reporter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday. It's August 7th, and it is the eve of the beginning of the Beijing Olympics. Tomorrow, August 8th at 8 p.m. China time, the games will begin. And we've been wondering, who are the athletes to watch? And we're asking you, who will you be watching? And Lloyd from Charlotte, North Carolina, told us on our website he's going to be watching the 100-meter race. I like watching it every year. I think he
it's
means every
exciting.
4 years or every year. not the Olympics, though.
Well, you can see the World Championships, not the Olympics, right. That's for sure.
So he's going to be watching that. And what about you? Let us know what you're looking out for on the Olympics. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Ollie Williams?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. And you know what to watch for, don't you, when the games begin?
Absolutely. I can't believe the games are beginning tomorrow. It feels as though I've been working on the Olympics for years and years, which, of course, I have. And it's brilliant that it's actually going to be kicking off properly tomorrow.
What's the air like?
What's the air like? Yeah, in Beijing. Well, I'm not actually in Beijing, but I can tell you the air in London is lovely. The air in Beijing.
All right. That's because you're in London, not in Beijing. There we go.
Ollie Williams is a BBC sports reporter, and you've been compiling your list, right, Ollie, from the blog that you've been writing on the BBC's website, an Olympic blog.
Yeah, that's right. We've got an Olympic blog, more than 30 authors, journalists, some of whom are in Beijing. They're luckier than me. Hundreds of thousands reading this blog, hundreds of comments. And last month, we decided we wanted to pick a selection of top international athletes to profile. But of course, it's a bit boring if just the journalists sit around a table and decide the same odd athletes. So yeah, we asked people to come up with a list. And then from everyone else's thoughts, we came up with our own list of 10.
Okay, so give us a few names.
Okay, well, to start with, you can either have the pole vault star with her own collection of dolphins or the long-distance swimmer with only one leg. Which would you rather have?
The dolphins.
We'll go with the dolphins. Okay, Yelena Isinbayeva. She's a pole vault star. She's 26, from Russia. Completely dominant in the pole vault. She's set more than 20 world records in her career, almost always breaking her own previous record. Her latest world record is a jump of 5 metres 4 centimetres at the end of July. So she's in great form for the Olympics.
Ollie, I'll take one-legged swimmers for 20, okay?
Okay, one-legged swimmers. Just to say, Yelena Isinbayeva has her own collection of dolphins. She owns them. I don't know how. We're trying to find that one out, but apparently she has her own dolphins. One-legged swimmer is Natalie Du Toit, 24, from South Africa. Lost a leg in a motorbike accident 7 years ago. She won 5 Paralympic gold medals in 2004, but this time she's in the Paralympics and in the Olympics as well, despite having only one leg. And she's a medal prospect in the 10-kilometer endurance swim, despite the fact she's only got one leg.
Wow, that's pretty...
Go, Natalie.
That's pretty impressive. Who else do you have on your list?
Okay, who else makes the list? I think you probably know this one. Michael Phelps, the swimmer. I'm sure every American knows this man's name. 23, from Baltimore. Won no fewer than 8 medals at the Athens Olympics. Won 7 golds at last year's World Championships. He's got world records coming out of his ears. He looks unstoppable. The big question is whether this guy's going to break Mark Spitz's record, which is 7 gold medals at one Olympics. He won that at Munich in 1972. If anyone's going to break that record, it'll be Phelps. It's going to be this year, and it'll be on US primetime television because they've swapped the swimming finals to the morning in China, so it'll be on primetime US television, so you'll be able to see it live.
It feels like he should be older than 23 because he's been such a superstar for
so
long.
He won his first Olympic medal aged 15.
Oh, wow. So this is 8 years later. He's got enough. Okay, next. Give us your next
one. Okay, well, speaking of 15-year-olds, how about a 14-year-old? This is a British kid called Tom Daly. He's a diving star. He's 14. He's from Devon, which is in the southwest corner of Britain. And he's 14 years old. He's going to an Olympic Games. What were you doing when you were 14, Adora?
I was at the Olympics.
You were at the Olympics, John. You're bringing me back,
Ollie.
I was a high dive.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be it. Yeah, I'm sure you were. Well, I'll tell you what, Tom Daly would have beaten you, I hate to tell you. He's the most media-friendly 14-year-old in the world. He wants to be a TV presenter once he retires, which is obviously a long, long way away. Probably not a realistic medal prospect, but so many divers make it to the Olympics at such a young age, and he's the one who's done it this time around. There's so many others. There's a Czech decathlete called Roman Sebrili, who is the real man of the year in the Czech Republic, winning ahead of a Czech pop singer and the country's president. Usain Bolt, the 100-meter, 200-meter sprinter, is in there. Obviously, he's a huge name, alongside the likes of Tyson Gay, Asafa Powell. If you're watching the 100 meters, I know someone said they were a moment ago.
Yes.
That's the name you're going to be looking out for, Usain
Bolt. What about Chinese athletes? Obviously, that's a point of much pride, given the fact that we're talking about the Beijing Olympics. Any contenders there?
Yeah, we talk about the 100 metres as though that's the showpiece event. The Chinese aren't going to be doing that. They're going to care about the 110-metre hurdles because Liu Zhang, who's 25 from China, is their big medal prospect, and he is the biggest athlete in China, in the world, as far as they're concerned. 110-meter hurdles is where it's at. He's going to feel as though the whole world is resting on his shoulders. He's got to go up against a Cuban called Darren Robles, and that's incredibly tough to call. because there's only 1/100th of a second between their
best
times.
Oh, my, 1/100th of a second. Ollie Williams, we're going to be watching for that. Thank goodness they have photo finishes. Otherwise, we might not be able to see it. Thank you so much, Ollie Williams.
No problem.
Liu Zhang is 110 meters tall. He must be the hugest athlete in the world.
Ollie Williams reports for the BBC. He's a sports reporter there, and he's working on their blog, their Olympic blog.
Love
on
Ollie.
The BBC's website. Thanks so much. And now we're moving on to Femi Okeh. He's got some headlines for us.
Hello there. 27 minutes past the hour. China is responding to a call by President Bush for greater rights for political dissidents and religious believers. In a statement posted on its website, China's foreign ministry said that no one should interfere in China's internal affairs. President Bush made his remarks in a speech in Bangkok. Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, is awaiting sentencing at Guantanamo Bay. A split jury found him guilty of supporting terrorism. Hamdan faces up to life in prison. The Justice Department says it's had enough evidence to convict Army scientist Bruce Ivins in the 2001 anthrax attacks that left five dead. They say that DNA from the anthrax used in the killings matched spores from his lab. Ivins committed suicide last week. A senior official from the UN nuclear agency is in Iran. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany are considering further sanctions on Iran if the country refuses to stop enriching uranium. And here's the biggest sports story of the morning. Brett Favre, the most famous quarterback in the country, is being traded by the Green Bay Packers and heading to New York Jets. So this is how I understand
it. The New York Jets.
Yes.
It was Tampa Bay yesterday.
Yes, it's different today. But this is how I understood it. I did a little bit of studying here. The better Favre plays for the Jets, the better player the Packers will get. But it's a little bit more complicated. So we're going to our control room for my sports editor, Jay Cowart. Jay.
Hey,
yeah. Good morning. Explain the trade to us, because it's a little bit more than the Jets get Favre and then the Jets give one back, because it depends how long Favre plays, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a conditional draft pick, which doesn't happen very often in the NFL. The Jets get the fourth round pick if Favre plays less than 50% of all the plays. If he plays more, they get a third round pick. If he plays 70% or more, they get a second round pick. And if they make the Super Bowl, John Adora, they get a first round pick.
So Green Bay's got to be rooting for Brett Favre.
Well, Favre has played seemingly every game since the Ice Bowl. He's started every game since 92. So this is pretty much a lock to be at least a third round pick, if not more.
Could they have made it just a little bit more complicated?
Well,
interesting stuff.
They could try.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning on this Thursday, August 7th. Right now, the U.S. has Afia Sadiqa, a 36-year-old Pakistani mother of three, in custody in New York City on charges of attempting to murder U.S. soldiers and FBI agents in Afghanistan. Sadiqi is accused also of having links to top al-Qaeda leaders. A far cry, say those who knew her, as a studious woman who went to Brandeis University and got a PhD in neurocognitive studies at MIT, married an anesthesiologist, and made her home in Boston. Joining us now is Imam Abdullah Farouk of the Mosque for the Praising of Allah in Boston, where Siddiqui once worshipped. Good morning and welcome, Imam.
Good morning and welcome to you, I guess.
Describe the woman that you say you knew 10 years ago in Boston.
Well, she's, I hope, still a physically slight, very beautiful, intelligent, and caring young lady. I don't know what her condition is now. Particularly intelligent and particularly concerned, not just for herself, but for others. And I don't just mean Muslims, but people in general. So that was the type of attitude and disposition that she expressed to us in our community.
Do you recall the first time that you met her?
I remember meeting her, not personally, but seeing her on campus at lectures, Islamic lectures at MIT and at other universities, BU and the like. You know, usually she was invited to speak because she was small but very, you know, very voicey about the lack of responsibilities that Muslim men had in taking care of their responsibilities as men. So she was very, she was a feisty young lady, but she wasn't. She wasn't very belligerent.
And you say that she was very involved in a lot of charity work. Can you tell us about that?
Well, not so much charity work. She was involved in charity work. She would give out food and the things like that with the Muslim Student Associations and the like. but she also was one who would I would see at running tables with Islamic literature and the like at certain Islamic functions when speakers would come in town.
Imam, was she political at all? And is there anything about the way she behaved when you knew her that would make plausible the charges that motivated the government to hold her here in New York?
No, I mean, she wasn't political. I mean, she wasn't, when you say political, I mean, she wasn't talking about political matters when she spoke about advising Muslim men to be responsible and taking care of their families and to, you know, to act like men. And encouraging men to act like men is not very political.
So would you would describe her as an observant religious woman who was dedicated to her studies?
Both academically, I didn't know her very well. I just knew that she was in, I think, MIT at the time. And but and she also gave classes, you know, on Islamic studies to other women. I don't know the women who were, you know, participating in her classes, but I do know that people were very satisfied because she was very well educated, both Islamically.
Well, what's your reaction to these charges? I mean, you sound a little skeptical, and which is fine. But what's your reaction?
My reaction is, I don't know what kind of I don't know. I'm not familiar with the stories at all. What you just said, something about her trying to murder FBI agents in Pakistan, you said?
In Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. I don't know what she was doing in Afghanistan, and I don't know how she'd be involved in trying to murder FBI agents. I don't know. I have no idea about that at all.
The FBI, did the FBI contact and interview you about her?
Well, I don't recall that. No, I don't.
And was there a reaction in the community by other people who knew her?
Well, some time ago, yes, her name was in the newspaper. And people knew her as being a mother and being a wife and being a student. I mean, these are not things that commensurate with the type of, disposition and character that we knew her.
So it sounds like people in the community are saying, these charges are mystifying, that they don't really believe, perhaps, that she could be involved in something like this.
Well, given the climate of the way things that we find what's going on, the waterboarding, I don't know what the American government's doing with people. I hear some very harrowing accounts of what they do to people in Abu Ghraib or what they're doing down in Guantanamo. And I don't know what she's doing in Afghanistan, but who knows? I mean, I'm not one to weigh our government. The newspapers and journals and television and radio are covering a great deal of things about mistreatment of people. So the government, I think, has a little to fear from a little girl about 5'1" and about 90 pounds.
Imam Abdullah Farouk, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. You have a good day.
You too. Imam Abdullah Farouk is from the Mosque for the Praising of Allah in Boston.
Expressing a certain amount of skepticism, I think it's fair to say.
And now we're going to turn to Femi Oke for the latest headlines of the day.
Hello there. It is 22 minutes to the hour. President Bush rebuked China for its record on human rights and individual freedoms in a speech in Bangkok earlier today. The president will land in Beijing later this morning. And in a statement posted on its website, China's foreign ministry said that no one should interfere in China's internal affairs. President Bush made his remarks in a speech earlier and is actually right now on his way in towards Beijing to join his father, who is already in Beijing, getting a front seat at the Olympics. A senior official from Pakistan's ruling coalition says that President Pervez Musharraf will face impeachment if he doesn't ask for a vote of confidence in the parliament. President Musharraf isn't likely to win that vote of confidence. More news out of Pakistan. The Pakistan military says that 25 pro-Taliban insurgents are dead after hundreds of fighters attacked a checkpoint near the Afghan border. Two Pakistani troops were also killed. A top UN nuclear watchdog official is in Tehran for talks today. Diplomats say it's a fresh effort to get the Iranians to clarify reports about their disputed nuclear program. There's widespread international condemnation today of the military junta that seized power in the northwestern African nation of Mauritania. On state television, the army has promised to hold free elections soon, but they didn't say when. And they also referred to President Abdullahi as the former president. And we were talking just a little bit earlier to Ollie Williams from the BBC about Olympians to watch out for.
That's right.
Have one more to add to the list. His name is Longue Lopez, and he's actually a Sudanese refugee. He was one of the young boys who was airlifted out of Sudan and came to live in the United States.
One of the lost boys.
Yes, one of the lost boys. Hmm. He will be carrying the U.S. flag in tomorrow's opening ceremony.
What's his event?
What's he competing
in? In athletics.
Athletics. I mean, so yeah. He's a runner or a track.
Yeah, he's a runner, right. He's track. But I want you to look at his arms when he's holding the flag up. His arms are longer than my legs. They're truly amazing.
Which is a great image for you listening to the radio this morning. maybe on our website we'll post Femi's legs and this athlete's arms so you can actually measure yourself.
I'm going to scan them right now.
On our website, responding to the interview we just did, who was the dean of admissions at the time the MIT-schooled enemy combatant was admitted to MIT, asks Ron. Of course, it's an allegation. It's not true yet. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 7th, and they're rocking in our control room here at The Takeaway. I'm Midora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. That is a song you may be familiar with right now, keeping with our Olympics theme, a day before the Olympics. It's called Welcome to Beijing, and it's the official countdown song to the 08 Olympics. But it's not the official song for the actual games yet. That song won't be unveiled until the games finally start tomorrow. It's a very different sound, this Chinese pop tune, than the sound of the games when they began. That anthem was composed by Spiros Samaras and was first played in the Olympic Games in Athens in 1896. It is still the official Olympic anthem, and it's played even today when the Olympic flag is raised. More than 30 years later, we get this sound.
Melody which you will hear undoubtedly many times, those of you who will attend the Olympic Games here in Los Angeles, will now be played by the band under Lieutenant Roberts' direction. I love you, California.
I love you, California didn't exactly stick, but it was the music used in the opening ceremony of the L.A. Games in 1932.
Boy, it really set those Olympics on fire.
That's right. And right before the Berlin Games of 1936, those were the games famously hosted by Adolf Hitler, the organizers wanted to create a brand new hymn for the 20th century. This was a commission from Adolf Hitler for composer Richard Strauss to come up with a song that could be the official anthem for all time. Didn't work out that way. But here's a fun fact for all you Americans who believe that this song is actually the anthem for the Olympics. It's called Bugler's Dream by composer Leo Arno. It's usually heard when you tune into the games on TV. That's where this song got its start. ABC used it for their TV coverage. NBC started using it in 1992. But the whole pop trend in Olympic theme songs, that began in earnest in 1988 in Seoul. Hand in hand we stand all across. That's Hand in Hand by the South Korean group Koreana. The song may not mean anything in this part of the world, but that band is still going strong in their home country, thanks to Olympic stardom. But a song that resonated more in the Western world came in 1992. Can you guess where this Olympics was? Barcelona. That's the late Freddie Mercury of Queen with the Spanish opera singer Montserrat Caballé, who both inaugurated the Barcelona Games with a duet that made it to the top of the charts in Europe. Things turned a little poppier with the 1996 Games in Atlanta. Gloria Estefan, her song Reach. But Bjork really got down to it when she started her song in 2004 with Your Sweat Tastes Salty.
Your sweat is salty.
Oh, I can't take it.
Thank you, Bjork.
I can't take it.
Thank you, Bjork. That was the 2004 games in Sydney. And in the meantime, you're going to have to wait for the official song for the 08 Olympics, but it will be tomorrow. Until then, we're going to just have to listen to this. Welcome to Beijing, everybody, including President Bush, who arrives today.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 7th, the eve of the Beijing Olympics, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Thanks very much. Earlier today, President Bush criticized China's human rights record in a speech, and Beijing has responded. A China spokesman said that no one should interfere in other countries' internal affairs. The Justice Department says it could have convicted Army scientist Bruce Ivins in the anthrax attacks that killed five people 7 years ago. They say that DNA from the anthrax used in the killing matches spores from his laboratory. The largest insurance company in the world, AIG, is announcing second quarterly losses of $5.4 billion. CEO Robert Williamstad is blaming the poor housing and credit markets for the company's problems. And it was 10 years ago today that Al-Qaeda bombed American embassies in Africa. The attacks in the capital cities of Tanzania and Kenya killed more than 200 people and injured more than 5,000. Ceremonies are underway to remember the victims. And that's a look at some of the main stories from this morning news headlines.
Thank you, Femi. A decade after the attacks on the embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, we are discussing today a verdict that was delivered yesterday in the trial of Salim Hamdan, the driver of Osama bin Laden, and the first military tribunal case since World War II, taken up by the Bush administration as part of their war on terror. It's silly to say our next guest wrote the book on the Hamdan trial, but it's actually factually correct. Jonathan Mahler, New York Times magazine reporter and author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, is in the studio with us. John, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, this verdict, it seems to me, it delivers a verdict on a process, and also reveals something of a tactic on the part of prosecutors. The material support for terror, which is what Salim Hamdan was convicted of, he was acquitted on the conspiracy charge, suggests that anybody who helps anyone who turns out to be a terrorist at any time can be roped in by military prosecutors. The question really for me to you, though, is what is the significance of this verdict historically as we go forward? There's more trials to come.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the big question now, I think, is whether Hamdan's lawyers are certainly going to appeal this verdict to the federal court system. It may end up back in the Supreme Court, and they're going to be challenging both sort of the proceedings of this trial and as well as the actual charge that he was convicted of, material support for terrorism, which they are going to argue is not a legitimate war crime. So in a sense, the tribunal system itself is still on trial, and we won't really know whether it's convicted or acquitted for months, if not years.
I mean, we should note that your book, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, refers to the case not in the military tribunal, but it refers to the case in federal court the entire process was challenged. It made it into federal court, and some amazing characters in the military justice system are involved in it. What's their reaction today? Any idea?
Well, yes. Their reaction is that these trials are they still maintain that these trials aren't fair, and they intend to continue to challenge them. I mean, I think, you know, in a sense, I think one of the greatest stories here is really the story of Hamdan's lawyers and the fact that this this accused terrorist and now convicted terrorist has received such a vigorous defense and largely, or at least in part, from military lawyers, from military officers, which I think does say great things. Whatever you think of these trials, it mm-hmm. does certainly say great things about America that they've gotten that defense. That's right, that these tribunals have already been challenged, in fact, two times in the Supreme Court, once in the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case and more recently in the Boumediene case. And the administration lost both times, mm-hmm. but they're clearly determined to continue ahead with these trials. So for at least the next few months, they're gonna keep pressing. And whether or not they're going to succeed in bringing anyone else to trial is I think, still an open question. But we know they're going to try.
Before I let our resident lawyer, Adoria Doji, at you,
I've got tape over my mouth because I'm dying to ask.
Well, I just want to ask you one simple question.
Sure.
With all the criticism for Rumsfeld about his the suspicion that he has no respect for habeas corpus and mm-hmm. basically, in the interest of security, will do almost anything.
Yes.
Were you surprised at the respect for traditional constitutional values that you found in the military justice system in the United States in your book?
I think I was initially, and then I was almost embarrassed that I was surprised by it, because as I looked around and got to know some of these JAG lawyers and military officers, it was sort of a given. And in the case of these guys, it was almost a twofold issue. They were both. These lawyers, these JAG lawyers, were both kind of fulfilling their obligation as attorneys to provide a vigorous defense for their clients, but they were also fulfilling their obligations as military officers. They were defending the Constitution, and that's their highest calling. And to them, the Constitution was telling them mm-hmm. something very, very different from what the Constitution was apparently telling the administration's lawyers. So, mm-hmm. I was initially surprised, but then I began to sort of take it as a given that in almost every case, the most outspoken critics of the system were in fact the top military lawyers.
And just to get back, because in your book you do talk about how there were some real concerns among JAG lawyers about the constitutionality of the setup of the entire process, but just to bring it to a micro level in terms of how the Hamdan's lawyers are going to appeal his case, mm-hmm. let's talk about this notion of materially supported terrorism. In the law, material has such a significant, specific meaning. It usually means something substantive, like it almost wouldn't have happened, whatever that bad thing is, without your contribution.
Right.
Can that be said in this trial against Salim Hamdan?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I mean, what has Hamdan really been convicted of doing? And it was, in fact, driving a car. I mean, he drove bin Laden around, and I think the government has argued that he helped bin Laden escape capture in the aftermath of the embassy attacks 10 years ago, exactly 10 years ago. But
how far can they go with that? I mean,
well,
didn't
exactly.
run him over with
exactly.
the car, didn't, made him a ham sandwich, didn't imprison him. I mean, what constitutes material support?
That's right. And I think that the other thing you have to keep in mind is that, we're dealing with material support as a war crime, as opposed to a crime in our criminal court system, where in our criminal court system has all of these great sort of due process defenses and sort of lines of defense, which don't necessarily exist in war crimes trials. So the context is completely different. And in fact, there really is, as far as I know, no precedent for material support for terrorism as a war crime. So I think Hamdan's lawyers are going to have a very, very strong argument that it's not a legitimate war crime. And if it gets overturned in the federal court system, there's going to be no conviction because Hamdan can't be retried.
And
for
John on our website says that giving Osama bin Laden a ham sandwich would be unlikely anyway, since he's an observant Muslim.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. Yes.
But what's fascinating there is that this notion, someone pointed out, well, what about Hitler's driver?
That's right.
This was a man who was never charged.
No,
he was never tried in any aspect. And we all know what kind of warmongering, criminal and murderer that Hitler was.
That's right. Even, frankly, the conspiracy charge, which Hamdan was acquitted of, wasn't used at Nuremberg, and there was a debate about it inside our own government about whether or not we should use the conspiracy charge at Nuremberg, and it was felt ultimately that it wasn't a good idea, that it would wrap in too many small small fries, guys like Hamdan,
right.
And it would, in so doing, kind of sort of detract from the moral force of these trials if you're putting on little guys on trial for conspiracies.
So the conspiracy charge didn't stick.
Yeah, but what is that exactly? What does that acquittal say for the government and their strategy moving forward?
Yeah, well, there are two ways of looking at it. And the government will say, and defenders of the administration will say that, look, this proves that these trials are fair. Hamdan was acquitted on one of the two charges. But then there are those who would say, if you flip a coin, it's going to come up heads 50% of the time and tails 50% of the time. So simply because he was acquitted on one of the two charges doesn't make the trials fair.
Well, the material support strategy is certainly a technique that's going to come up. We got the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial that's moving forward. I admire your timing. The challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the fight over presidential power, is out right now, correct?
Yes.
Author Jonathan Mahler is our guest, and thanks so much for being with me.
My pleasure.
We could talk about Jonathan for, the next hour.
Easily.
We're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on our website as well as Facebook, Twitter, and Friend Feed.
Our Veep Stakes trading is still going strong on Facebook, and almost 1,000 of you are playing our game where you get to pick the candidates before McCain and Obama do. You're running out of time, so quickly jump on board.
Buy stocks of the vice presidents you like. There are some hot tips. Disagreement on Obama's running mate from our traders. Marcus Lang says, it won't be Evan Bayh. Think about it. We need 60 in the Senate. Indiana's governor is a Republican. It's going to be Biden by Biden.
Yeah, but Antoine Hardy says Evan Bayh is gaining momentum. So join us on the Veep Stakes. Go to thetakeaway.org to start trading.
More on the verdict on today's Takeaway, both on our website and on the air. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You could say Paul Robeson begets Kanye West.
Tell all Pharaoh to let my people go.
I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. This top floor, if you alone, I leave you breathless. Try to catch it. It's kind of hard getting choked by the
prospect of a Barack Obama presidency looms as more than a pipe dream, just as black leaders from the early days of the civil rights movement are being succeeded by a new generation. The torch will be passed, but does anything get dropped in the process? A relay on race. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 7th, and boy, that was vivid. Robeson to Kanye West. Anyhow, we're taking a look at generational politics and the rise of Barack Obama. Also, California and federal investigators say they've broken up an enormous hospital fraud scam involving homeless recruits. The historic terror trial against Osama bin Laden's former driver ends in a split decision, or a split verdict, I should really say. What's next? And what do you do if someone steals your credit card or identity? We'll take a look. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora. President Bush is on his way to Beijing, and he may be facing an unfriendly welcome after he criticized China on its human rights record in a speech in Bangkok.
America stands in firm opposition to China's detention of political dissidents and human rights advocates and religious activists.
In a statement posted on its website, China's foreign ministry says no one should interfere in China's internal affairs. The FBI has released hundreds of documents they say show Army scientist Bruce Ivins was the sole perpetrator in the 2001 anthrax attacks. The documents say Ivins was the only person who had the unique strain of anthrax that killed five people. He committed suicide last week.
The governing coalition in Pakistan has agreed in principle to launch impeachment proceedings against President Pervez Musharraf. They're expected to make a formal announcement within hours. Musharraf has previously said he would rather resign than face impeachment. At Guantanamo Bay, sentencing proceedings continue today against Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan. He was convicted yesterday of providing material support to al-Qaeda, but acquitted of conspiracy charges. Here's the ACLU's Ben Weisner.
Never in the history of the law of war has a military tribunal been convened to punish such a low-level offender for such low-level charges.
The ACLU has been very critical of the War Crimes Tribunal. Hamdan faces life in prison.
Today marks the 10-year anniversary of the bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. More than 200 people were killed in the coordinated attacks. Thousands more were wounded.
And here's one of our favorite topics. Brett Favre, a Green Bay Packer no longer. He's been traded to the New York Jets. That's good news for Aaron Rodgers, who is now firmly expected to start for Green Bay.
John McCain campaigns in Ohio today. Barack Obama begins the day in Minneapolis before heading home to Chicago. Oil was down slightly. The S&P begins trading at 1289. We're asking, is there a generational change in African-American politics? We'll have a debate or a discussion on that later in the show. But what do you think? Does Barack Obama represent a new generation, or is he in a long tradition? Reach us at 877-8MY-TAKE. We're also talking about grief. How do you deal with it? Does time heal all wounds? On The Takeaway.
Good morning on this Thursday, August 7th. We're going to start in California, where in Los Angeles, federal and state investigators say they've unraveled a sophisticated and, frankly, a shocking fraud scheme involving hospital executives, doctors, and homeless advocates, where they say hundreds of homeless people were recruited in a scam that went on for years and bilked the state and federal health systems out of millions of dollars. Two people, a hospital administrator and a homeless advocate, have been arrested, and officials say they have many more arrests to make. For more on this developing story, we turn now to Brian Watt of Southern California Public Radio, KPCC. Good morning. Very early there, Brian.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning.
Unravel this case for us. And first, if you could just give us a little description of Skid Row. It really is an unusual place in Los Angeles, very unique to that city.
Yes, a multi-block area where basically homeless people reside as best they can. There are a lot of shelters. There are missions that try to serve the homeless. And if a scheme like this is looking for homeless people to use in order to bilk, this is where you would go in Los Angeles to find those people. And they set up this assessment center right in the heart of Skid Row, essentially in this building that housed what appeared to be storefront churches when I went there. And the people that you encounter there are, you know, you certainly get the impression that they are mentally ill or that they have some sort of substance abuse problem. And so here is apparently where the pipeline of homeless patients, quote unquote, was started and funneled to these three hospitals here in Southern California.
And it was a very intricate system. So someone would recruit these homeless people, according to investigators.
Right.
Offer them $20 to $30. What would happen? They would be taken to a hospital. Then what happened?
So, yeah, apparently you had a sort of a group of runners or stringers, depending on which claim or which indictment you're reading, who would go out into Skid Row onto the streets and recruit these people. They didn't show up necessarily at this assessment center by themselves. The runners or stringers would go out, recruit them, ask them if they were on Medicare and Medi-Cal. If they said yes, if they did qualify for these health care benefits, then they would be invited. They would be encouraged to go to this assessment center there at Skid Row and promised payments of up to $30. Some people got $20. Some people got $30. And they'd get to this assessment center where apparently there was some medical staff. Investigators say a lot of the staff there was untrained. And the staff there would essentially cook up phony diagnoses, in some cases cook up false medical records, and refer these folks to one of three hospitals. And it happened in a lot of cases it happened over and over again for the same homeless person.
And a doctor would be involved, according to an investigator, would actually sign off on this now phony trail for this individual.
Absolutely. Doctors at the hospitals are also named in the complaint. The admitting physicians. So this is one of those cases that goes from the street all the way to the guy who set up the assessment center on Skid Row to the admitting physician there at the hospital. and to the CEO of the hospital. So yeah, it would go from street all the way to hospital, and then of course Medicare or Medi-Cal, which is our state-run insurance program, would be billed.
Finally, very quickly, how much money are they alleging was bilked through this process?
Well, we're talking about, I was looking at figures in the LA Times this morning, $10 million is an estimate that's out there right now in terms of what the government lost to this scheme.
$10 million, wow.
$10 million, thousands of homeless people run through this pipeline.
Brian Watt, thank you so much for that update.
Thank you.
Brian Watt is a reporter for Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, and clearly lots more to come on that story.
Well, the sad irony is, of course, that's an underserved population that probably needs more health care, yet they're objects and candidates for a fraud scam. It's really, really tragic. All right, we're going to shift gears here and talk about President Bush and China. It's fair to say that President Bush did not discover China just the other day.
This accident has the potential of undermining our hopes for a fruitful and productive relationship between our two countries. To keep that from happening, our servicemen and women need to come home.
Maybe difficult to recall, but that's President Bush speaking back in April of 2001. Bush was dealing with a crisis between the U.S. and China when a U.S. spy plane collided with a Chinese fighter jet in international airspace over the South China Sea. China was holding service members, and that was the president demanding their return. But how does President Bush sound yesterday, speaking in a speech in Bangkok, Thailand?
We speak out for a free press, freedom of assembly, and labor rights, not to antagonize China's leaders, but because trusting its people with greater freedom is the only way for China to develop its full potential.
President Bush speaking last night in Bangkok. He's now on his way into Beijing to attend the Olympics. And Jonathan Head of the BBC World Service, I think it's fair to say that while those remarks were critical, a very lukewarm kind of tepid criticism that the Chinese leadership can't be too unhappy about. What do you think?
Well, the Chinese have reacted in the same well-rehearsed way that the president himself presented his concerns on human rights. They said you can't interfere in our internal affairs, but nobody's expecting a diplomatic row over this. The president had to say something on human rights when you remember those recent violent events in Tibet, all the people who want him to do that. He couldn't really do it in Beijing itself. That would have soured what's essentially a sporting event. And he's made it clear he wants his time in China to be seen as essentially there to support the U.S. teams in the Olympics. So he's made it in Thailand before he's arrived. The Chinese knew what was coming. And yes, it was criticism, but tempered by the fact it was more of an appeal, if you like. He said, we're doing this in the hand of friendship. We want you to fulfill your potential. And he made it very clear. He said, look, change is going to happen in China, but it will happen on China's own terms, with a reference to its own history. This is a very different president from the one we heard from back in April of 2001. No longer talking about China as a strategic competitor. He talked about engagement and dialogue. It was all very, very couched in soft terms, and I think he's really careful to avoid offense here.
Well, Jonathan, I take your point. A well-rehearsed appeal from a lame duck president in probably his last Asian speech is not the biggest headline in world affairs. Yet, if we take the long view, as you just did a moment ago, we can see that over the last nearly 8 years, China has had it its own way in this relationship, and that's perhaps the legacy here. Do you agree?
China's a very powerful country in this region, and the countries in this region have recognized that. There's also a recognition, and it's something that the president glossed over in his speech, but you sensed he was attending to this, that the U.S. took its eye off the Asian ball. There was such a preoccupation with terrorism in the Middle East after 9/11 that there really wasn't much involvement in Asia. There were a couple of very big Asian summits which Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice didn't show up to, was seen as a very bad mark. The U.S. in the last 9 months has made a conscious effort to re-engage with Asia, and the president made that point in his speech. But a lot of countries here, China is now recognized as realistically as an enormous power, and that's something that any U.S. administration would have had to deal with. You can argue about how well this president has handled Asia, and many people are critical of him. He tried to answer those critics in his speech, but the reality is China is a rising power. It's not up to the levels of the U.S. yet, and you simply can't push him around. When you listen to his language on Burma, and he's been talking a lot about Burma here in Thailand, of course he's a lot tougher, but he can be a lot tougher. The U.S. has a lot less to lose with Burma.
Well, it's an interesting legacy point here. I mean, Bush actually got into some trouble, or at least raised some controversy during his campaign back in 2000, saying that the Middle East didn't matter so much, that Asia was the big issue. And as you say, for the last 8 years, Asia has really been ignored. The ball has been dropped. The next American president will be dealing with Asia in very much the same way as the U.S. claimed it would be in 2000, correct?
I think so. There's no doubt. When you look at the economic relationships, this region is profoundly important, and there are massive challenges here. Dealing with China is immensely difficult for every country. It's a superpower, but it's very prickly. It's very secretive. Its human rights problems are in the open. They're brazen. They really upset people. You've got North Korea to deal with as well. This president has been defined by 9/11. He described himself for so many years as a war president. It's not no real surprise that he took his eye off Asia. Many say he should have got it back on Asia much sooner. The next president, realistically, will be trying to juggle a whole bunch of strategic challenges,
well, Jonathan,
none of which is straightforward.
Thank you. Jonathan Head speaking from Bangkok, Thailand, about a president narrowly defined by 9/11 in an Asian world. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Plenty to respond to in the program this morning. If you agree that the United States dropped the ball on Asia, as the BBC was telling us a moment ago, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, in a broader, maybe more personal subject, do you think that grief is just one of life's events, or is it more of a physiological phenomenon? Does it affect you deeply in biological terms? What is your story of grief? Where does it live in your brain, in your heart, in your soul? Give us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. Or you can reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Virginia Eskridge from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
Virginia, when somebody says to you, time will heal all wounds, and, you know, why don't you just get over it, I gather that's not something that you respond to terribly well.
No, it's not. I was very stunned to find that the grief I experienced went on for 20 years. I think the same things have been said about depression, and I think we've discovered that depression is an entity unto itself.
And grief is something actually worth exploring. Virginia, describe briefly what it is that happened to you 20 years ago, and then I want to bring Mary Frances O'Connor on to talk about what it took for you to get beyond at least the initial sense of grief. Okay, Ginny?
Yes. Actually, it was 25 years ago. I went through the therapy program with Dr. Catherine Cheer at the University of Pittsburgh 5 years ago. What happened is that my husband and I got together in, I guess you could call it middle age. I was in my mid-30s. He was in his mid-40s. We had been friends for years, but we had both been divorced. And we got together and were just crazy about each other. We had a wonderful marriage. We were so in love that we used to wake up in the morning and just grin at each other. I had a little boy, Jesse, and Fred just absolutely loved Jesse. So we were very, very happy. And 6 years into the marriage, he developed a brain tumor, which I didn't know at the time, but is pretty much uniformly fatal. So we went through the process of trying to heal that, and of course it didn't work. So he died in 1983, and I was just, of course, devastated, as was our son, who was then 12, and I just couldn't function. I had been a very active person. I was a reference librarian at a law school in Pittsburgh. I was about to start law school myself, And which my husband totally supported. He was an anthropology professor at a local women's college, and he was very much a feminist, and was just happy and proud of me that I'd be willing to tackle law school at that age.
Ginny, I can hear the closeness in your relationship and the deep sadness that you must have felt from your loss, but let's talk about this 20-year journey. Mary Frances O'Connor joins us now. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA. Mary Frances, so what was going on, as you are beginning to understand it, physiologically in Ginny Eskridge?
Good morning.
And good morning.
Well, we were surprised as we embarked upon this study to find that the group of people we investigated who were adapting well had a very different response in their brain than people who were not adapting well, people who were undergoing what Ginny probably experienced.
And it's something that you've begun to describe as complicated grief, and it apparently affects perhaps a million Americans. Grieving that becomes a physical condition that affects a distinct part of the brain. How do you treat such a thing?
Yes, so complicated grief has a distinct set of symptoms. It only affects 10 to 20% of people who are bereaved, but of course that's a large number of people. It's something that lasts for more than 6 months and affects every day and is found to contain, people feel just intense yearning and that the future is somewhat purposeless, and they may feel extremely angry or bitter about the death. And as Ginny mentioned, Dr. Catherine Scheer has developed some treatment for it that fits very well with what we've found in this group of people in the brain when they're looking at a picture of the deceased or are reminded of a memory of the deceased. Hmm.
So, Ginny, you had to break specific patterns of thought to even get close to getting beyond your grief. Can you describe that to me?
Yes, I can. And I think I didn't quite emphasize enough how totally debilitated I was. I mean, there were actually years that went by that I couldn't do anything but lay on the couch and cry. I mean, I was just incapacitated. I wound up with some social withdrawal because, you know, when you go out for dinner with your friends and you burst into tears when somebody mentions your husband's name, that's not good for the social event. So at any rate, what happened was I just sheer luck, I stumbled upon a brochure about Dr. Scheer's grief program and decided to go to check it out. And I'm very skeptical about things in general, and I was skeptical about this, whether it would work, and I, especially after 20 years, but I decided to sign up. And the treatment is sort of, I guess it's like a desensitization in a way. It was a 5 months of very intense therapy every week. I had to go and make an audio tape and a videotape of the therapy with my wonderful therapist, Bonnie Gorsak.
And Ginny, the strategy was really to get you away from a kind of clinging to happy thoughts and moving you away from patterns of memory that would put you back on the couch crying, right?
Yes, right, except in my case it was a little different, I think, or maybe not different, but the thoughts were not necessarily happy. They were thoughts of how his suffering with his illness,
right.
But of course the happy thoughts were there and needed to be unburied.
Well, Ginny, we just have a couple of seconds here, and I want to sort of conclude with Mary Frances. What is the takeaway, I guess, what are people who are experiencing something like this to make of your results, and where do they go from here, quickly?
Well, we found that brain areas that are not conscious are being evoked in these folks who are not adapting well. So it isn't necessarily a conscious process. And so these folks aren't doing this on purpose. It's not something they can just set aside. Mm-hmm. And so if people are experiencing this, it's something they may want to seek help with a support group or with a professional.
And it's a deep physiological phenomenon that you simply can't get over. Mary Frances O'Connor, thanks for joining me. Also, Ginny Eskridge, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 7th, and we have some headlines for you from Femi Oke. Fem?
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 27 minutes to the hour. Main stories making the news this morning. China's foreign ministry is responding to President Bush's criticism of its human rights record. On its website, it says that no one should interfere in China's internal affairs. President Bush will land in Beijing this morning. The Justice Department says it's had enough evidence to convict Army scientist Bruce Ivins in the 2001 anthrax attacks that left five people dead. They say that DNA from the anthrax used in the killings matched spores from his lab. Ivins committed suicide last week. And a senior official from the UN nuclear agency is in Iran. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany are considering further sanctions on Iran if the country refuses to stop enriching uranium. And that's a quick look at your headlines.
Thank you, Femi. So yesterday, as we've talked about repeatedly in the program, there's a verdict in the Salim Hamdan case after 2 weeks of testimony and about 8 hours of deliberation. Salim Hamdan, the Yemeni man known as Osama bin Laden's former driver, faces the possibility of life in prison. Joining us now is U.S. Army Prosecutor Colonel Lawrence J. Morris, who's the chief prosecutor in the Hamdan case and has been on the Takeaway before. Good morning, Colonel.
Good morning.
So you got one charge in the material support for terror, and the conspiracy charge apparently didn't stick, at least in the view of the jury. What do you make of this split verdict here?
I think it reflects the careful thought that you want a jury to put into a case. As you mentioned, they did acquit him on conspiracy, and they convicted him of five different specifications of material support for terrorism. The key one among them being lending his talents, his skill to al-Qaeda as a member of al-Qaeda over a period of many years. You know, it reinforced the government's main thrust, which is that he's a career al-Qaeda warrior.
And what burden do you believe that you have to show that the material support that he delivered may or may not have been crucial in particular events that resulted in the deaths of Americans in this particular case?
That's not the burden. And we have never asserted, as you know, that he is a mastermind. I mean, we've been very careful to make clear that he is not a mere driver, as you and so many other people report, but neither is he the key central figure. What he represents is a member of a number of those key indispensable insiders who keep people like Osama bin Laden safe, who make it much more likely, much more possible for them to carry out their terrorist aims. So he is an important member of that organization, but no one person is indispensable,
well,
of course.
You've given a couple of adjectives there, important and indispensable insider. Now, are those specific tests that the court would need to have proved in order to declare this material support of a criminal nature?
You must show that he had criminal intent, certainly. What you need not show is tying him to any particular discrete act. I mean, he has worked for al-Qaeda for many years, well before September 11th. So, therefore, he was part of the al-Qaeda organization, you know, for the U.S. Cole, for the East Africa bombings, well back to the 1990s. But what material support requires is his knowing, so it still is criminal intent, his knowing contribution of his skills to that organization, knowing it is a terrorist organization with terrorist aims. So that is the proof that we were required to reach beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, this morning we've been talking with Jonathan Mahler, who's a reporter for the New York Times Magazine and someone that you know because you appear in his book. I know that he's spoken to you. He had a question for you that came up in the course of our conversation. In John Mahler's book, you are at least initially critical of the Bush administration's tribunal process as it was originally envisioned. And the design changed, and I presume in part because of your concerns. How differently was the tribunal that we saw in the Hamdan case from what was originally envisioned?
I haven't read his book, and I don't know that I was a critic. I simply was somebody who, among many people, engaged in what was a tremendous, productive internal debate over how best to shape military commissions in this generation, a commission process that's been used many times, as you know, from George Washington through World War II. Some of the adjustments that came after the Supreme Court's decision in 2006 made it an even more just process, put in even more protections for the accused, all of which lead you to what you as a citizen, what all of us want, which is to be able to have confidence in the result that the jury brings down. So one of the changes, an example, is that now going forward, Mr. Hamdan has the potential of three levels of appeal, really four levels of review. First, it will go to the convening authority, who has total authority to adjust the findings and sentence, but only in his favor, then to an independent appellate court automatically, and then potentially to the D.C. Circuit and potentially to the Supreme Court.
But that raises, that begs a certain question. Why not just do this in federal court to begin with, if these appellate reviews are so important?
Because appellate reviews, however structured, are meant to test the trial process. It's at the trial process that we have to also be candid and clear that there are distinctions that make this an appropriate mechanism, and I'll mention a couple of them very quickly. The two most significant practical ones are that there is some evidence that it would be tougher to admit under the ordinary rules of evidence in federal and civilian courts, and that particularly has to do with how we get evidence. We're gathering evidence on a battlefield without the ability to scramble and get search warrants, to perfect chain of custody in the way that you would do in a civilian court, to go through the process of reading rights to people when you're questioning them with operational concerns. So it doesn't mean all that evidence automatically comes in, and it doesn't mean the jury must trust it, but it means that you open the opportunity to present such evidence and then test it for reliability.
I wasn't aware, Colonel Morris, that Salim Hamdan was apprehended on a battlefield.
He was apprehended driving his vehicle toward the battlefield. Sure, he was apprehended by military personnel.
All right. Just before we go, Mr. Charles Swift, who is a former Navy lawyer who has represented Mr. Hamdan, described this process as a made-up tribunal to try anybody we don't like. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Of course it's not. Mr. Swift is part of what has been a wonderful defense team. You saw them. I mean, this is a multi-thousands-page record of trial already because you had some civilians, as well as military, as well as DOD civilians, defending this man over months of time in wonderfully well-litigated series of motions that made the government work hard, put the government to the test about the theory of this process, as well as finally the actual proof that had to be represented to convince an independent jury of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
You got one and you lost one. Colonel Lawrence, thanks so much for being with us.
Next, sir.
Chief Prosecutor in the Hamdan trial, Colonel Lawrence Morris. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and we're talking consumer credit.
They say a man should always dress for the job he wants. So why am I dressed up like a pirate in this restaurant? It's all because some hacker stole my identity. Now I'm in here every evening serving chowder and iced tea. Should have gone to freecreditreport.com. I could have seen this coming at me like a net.
Okay, well, that's a little chuckle here or there, kind of funny, yeah. Well, today, 41 million people may want to be looking over their shoulders because they may be victims of a fraud ring that's triggered charges against 11 people in what's being described as the country's largest case of identity theft. The groups are accused of swiping over 40 million credit and debit card numbers mined from major retailers like Barnes & Noble's, BJ's, popular places that all of us go. And for more on how to watch your back is Bob Tiernan, Managing Editor of Consumer Reports. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
41 million numbers is a lot. How do any of us know if our numbers are in that bunch?
Well, it's very hard to find out, but what you can do personally is monitor your credit card accounts so that, you know, the first warning sign is that there are charges that you don't recognize, showing up on your statement.
Now, I think you actually recommend checking your credit reports every 4 months.
Yes. You know, under law, you're allowed to request for free from each of the credit reporting agencies a look at your annual credit report. And what we recommend that you do is ask for one every 4 months so that over the course of a year you can check to see if somebody, for example, has taken your Social Security number and opened up a credit card account either under your name or under their own name and started charging things against it.
And what if I find that is the case? It's not just that simple of reporting it to my bank or my credit card company.
Well, fortunately, one of the things that happens with credit card fraud is that if you're generally limited to $50 of liability, so it's the consumer has a lot of protection for that. But if it's a debit card or if it's an ATM card, you really have to get on it very quickly and report it because the limits go up the longer you wait.
All right, give us the suggestions on what we can do to help ourselves.
Well, one of the things that you might consider is putting a freeze on your credit accounts so that only you can ask for credit lines to be extended. There are 46 states that currently allow consumers to say, you know, if somebody applies for a credit line, they can't get it unless they get my permission. And, you know, that way, if you're applying for a loan yourself, you can unfreeze the lines and take a look at it yourself so that you can make sure nobody else is doing it on your dime, basically.
And you also suggest that we don't carry our Social Security cards around in our wallet. Right.
Right. If you lose your wallet and your Social Security card is like the key to all of your credit lines and personal information. And something else we found out when we did our article in the September issue is that your Social Security number is also on your Medicare cards and on cards issued by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, there's a letter in front of it, but that's essentially the same as your Social Security number anyway. So be careful with those as well.
We need to be careful and also just hope that we aren't plain unlucky. Bob Tiernan, Managing Editor of Consumer Reports, many thanks to you.
All right, thank you.
Boy, it's tough because if they get your numbers, John, you're in trouble.
I would change into a different identity, a completely different identity. I would become Paris Hilton.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with a quick check of headlines from Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the hour. Mind your own business. That's the message from China's foreign ministry after President Bush rebuked Beijing's human rights record in a speech earlier today. President Bush will arrive in China in just a few hours to attend the opening of the Summer Olympics. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf is facing impeachment. A senior official from the country's ruling coalition says they've agreed to begin proceedings against the president. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is calling for the release of the Mauritanian president and prime minister after yesterday's coup in the West African nation. There's been a chorus of international condemnation of the military junta that's taken power, the junta referring to the president as the former president. And that's a quick look at your main news headlines.
Thank you very much, Femi.
We know that the presidential election this year, the whole process has triggered all kinds of unprecedented questions. And today we take a look at Barack Obama and his historic candidacy. What has it meant for the African-American community? Questions about whether Obama symbolizes a new generation of African-American leaders have certainly come up time and again. The question is, has the baton been passed? To talk about this is joining us now is Matt Bai, a New York Times correspondent who's just written the article, Is Obama the End of Black Politics? It will be in the New York Times Magazine this weekend. Also joining us is Takeaway contributor David Wall Rice, a psychology professor at Morehouse College in Atlanta. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank
How you doing?
Matt, so has the baton been passed?
Well, I think it's in the process of being passed, if that makes sense. I think there's been a generational transformation happening for a while in African-American politics, as it does in all communities and in politics in general. But I think what Obama's campaign has done is really to thrust that transformation more out into the open and expose it and accelerate it and create some tension that might not have been there otherwise, because people had to choose up sides early on, which doesn't always happen in a generational change. And I think if you look at
you
the
mean
black
you're talking about people had to black folks had to make a decision as to whether or not to support Obama or to support Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the other black politicians around Obama's age, and I interview many of them for the piece, if not him, we would be talking about other politicians in the years to come. But you will have, I think, over the next decade, a new class of black politicians who are winning statewide offices and representing much broader constituencies than they have in the past, regardless of Obama.
And what makes them different? What makes Obama different from previous leaders or this new group, as you describe them? What makes them different than prior?
Well, I think, again, it's a transformation that happens in a lot of communities, and part of it is about the ambition to represent broader constituencies, whereas this generation of leaders that came before, really, their best option was to represent chiefly black constituencies, either in Congress or as mayors. They were limited in what they could actually aspire to because of the political climate in the country, no matter how talented they were. And I think that changes the kind of representation you get. And just as we once had Irish politics or Italian politics that was focused very much only on the community, those constituencies became part of democratic politics and part of American politics because they really mainstreamed. And I think when that happens, there are trade-offs, because you get these visible leaders representing much broader constituencies, mm-hmm. but you also can lose that focus on the issues that particularly affect that community, and that's especially critical in the black community, where you do have these very high rates of poverty and difficulty, and also disparities with mm-hmm. the white population in a whole host of areas.
Let's bring in David on this conversation. David, in your mind, Obama represents the opportunity to talk about some of this evolution, but this notion of generational shift in terms of the priorities of national black leaders has really been going on for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the things that we're talking about, and, you know, Matt wrote a great piece for the Sunday Times, but a lot of those folks that he's talking about are folks that have been in the mix for a long time. I mean, you know, I wrote articles for Vibe magazine that referenced, you know, Cory Booker and Harold Ford and Jesse Jackson Jr. and the like 10 years ago. So certainly
the new generation.
The new generation, mm-hmm. yes. So certainly we do see some type of generational shift, but I think that the question that is posed, at least in Matt's article, is Obama the end of black politics? It's certainly not the case. I think it provides, you know, race oftentimes provides, you know, an opportunity to look at problems or opportunities. So certainly Obama offers an opportunity for us to look at the different wrinkles and textures and nuances of black politics. And certainly, you know, what we're looking at right now and what we're talking about very much is mainstream politics. You know, if we talk about, you know, Obama, Deval Patrick, Arthur Davis, Michael Nutter, you know, all those folks are mainstream. And I think that, you know, they also are personalities. And so, you know, if you're looking at personality politics, it becomes important to look at how these individuals have been socialized. You're looking at, you know, the vast majority of them are coming out of Ivy League institutions. And so there's a different type of base that these individuals are operating from than perhaps a generation before. However, there are still individuals that hold tight to some of the ideals and fundamental issues that black folks are concerned about. If you look at folks like Kevin Powell, who's running for the 10th congressional seat in Brooklyn, of course. If you look at Otis Moss III, who is, you know, head of Trinity Church in Chicago.
And you're referring to a whole batch of even younger. I mean, they're sort of in their early 30s or younger. But let me just hold you
sure.
there for one second, Dave, because
sure.
I want to go back to Matt. In your article, you do reference that there is a distinct difference of where the politicians, like, say, John Lewis from down south, he was part of the civil rights movement, and that was his launching point. And many other black leaders, elected officials, have come out of a church background, have come sort of through the ranks in a very community-driven way, and how that's very different for those post-civil rights leaders, the young ones we're seeing coming up now.
It really is, and it's possible, you know, and I try not to in the piece to make too much of this and to draw too bright a line, because, you know, obviously there are a lot of shared values and shared experiences, and it's not adversarial in every way or even in most ways, but there is a real difference of experience here because of the way they've grown up. There's an interesting conversation in the piece with Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, you know, and who's sort of a national sensation, and he talks about his experiences with racism and the generation of politicians like himself or an Arthur Davis or Barack Obama or many others, and you know, he discusses experiences that really for him stressed his otherness around other white kids, that they wanted to feel his hair, that they wanted to compare their vacation tans to him, and clearly these were actually searing experiences for him and people of his generation, because he saw himself as not that different from his classmates, and these were experiences that made him feel very different. But it's a whole world different, as he pointed out to me, from his parents or his grandparents or some of the congressmen I was talking to who'd been beaten about the head and who'd had to enter through whites-only entrances and couldn't eat at the same restaurants. So, you know, you have in every generation in America and anywhere, of course, there's a difference in experience, but here you really have this massive chasm in a pretty short time because of the success of the civil rights generation and the changes they brought about, and that is bound to create some turbulence politically.
And David, isn't that what we see now, and it can be described as an expansiveness of black politics, as you've said?
I think so. I mean, I don't think of it in terms of a chasm so much as really, again, the complicating of the black experience and the black political experience. I mean, you know, so many times there is this idea of who is our black leader. So is Obama the black leader, or is somebody like a Deval Patrick and a lot of list of other folks who are in mainstream politics? And I think that what becomes important is to look at the breadth and depth of political leadership and to look at how that very much is, you know, looks like the mirror of America. I mean, if you look at the leadership in other types of communities and within the white community overall, and you hear this all the time, you're not looking for one specific leader. You're looking at different types of leadership. And I think that what Obama's presidency looks like is that it provides us an opportunity, again, to look at the wrinkles and the nuances and the complications of black politics.
The nuances. Matt Bye, New York Times writer and author of Is Obama the End of Black Politics? Thank you.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And his article, by the way, I should note, is on the New York Times website at the moment. And David Walrice, our takeaway contributor, thank you, sir.
Thank you. You take care.
And he's also, David Walrice is also a professor at Morehouse College in Atlanta.
What an interesting discussion of politics growing up and reflecting a diversity within a community that's
evolving.
Been looked at. Yeah, very much
evolution,
so.
Changing.
We're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on our website as well as Facebook and Friend Feed. Lots to see and do. There's a lot going on the Veep Stakes. Be sure to check into that.
Does anything get dropped in the process? I think John Hockenberry actually had that right at the top in this new generation of black leadership. Let us know what your take is on that at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Here's our takeaway from this hour.
When you go out for dinner with your friends and you burst into tears when somebody mentions your husband's name, that's not good for the social event.
That's Virginia Eskridge from Pittsburgh, who was diagnosed for complicated grief. We talked about how grief is something more than just needs getting over.
And you can learn more on our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is
The Takeaway.
The Takeaway.
The Takeaway, that's right, The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.